Welcome to Podcast One. We hope you'll support our sponsors who bring you these podcasts absolutely free and with limited interruptions. And of course, we appreciate you listening to this show, which will get started in just a second.
The following program is brought to you by your friends at Podcast One.
He's an American icon who fought World War II, gave you Martin and Lewis, Martha Ray, George Gobel, Tennessee Ernie Ford, Andy Williams, Fried Green Tomatoes, Spinal Tap, The Princess Bride, The Sure Thing, Stand By Me, The Declaration of Independence, People for the American Way, and a few TV shows.
Maybe you've heard of a couple of these.
All in the Family, Sanford and Son, Maude, Good Times, The Jeffersons, Hot L, Baltimore, One Day at a Time, Mary Harmon, Mary Harmon, The Dumplings, All's Fair, All the Glitters, Fernwood Tonight, America Tonight, Different Strokes, The Facts of Life, The Baxters, Archie Bunker's Place, Silver Spoons, Gloria, Square Pegs, a.k.a. Pablo, Who's the Boss, 227, Sunday Dinner, The Powers That Be, 704, Houser, Channel 11 and 3, One Day at a Time on Netflix.
All of the above with Norman Lear. It's all of the above with Norman Lear. No matter who you are, no matter what you do, you know that Norman Lear is just another version of you.
So, Paul, hey. Here we are again.
Here we are, all of the above.
All of the above with Norman Lear and his buddy and helpmate and what else do they call it?
Sidekick.
Sidekick, Paul Hipp. And great friend.
Yeah, and personal guitar player. I'm your personal guitar player, too.
Yeah. And we are expecting another terrific guy and great friend.
Talk about a guitar player, musician, legend.
Oh, does he do those things?
Yeah.
Oh,
I didn't a little know bit, a little really? Bit. I'm pretty sure. I think he knows his way around a guitar a little bit.
Oh, does he know a way around? You want to hear a little story about him?
Yes, please.
That I don't even know if I told him, but...
We haven't even told them who he is, have we?
My daughter Madeline wished to go to Austin, to the...
Austin City Limits?
Austin City Limits. And... And T-Bone was playing there, and he's playing with, I got to ask him when he comes in, because I never remember their names. He just stars. And so we were on the stage as a result of knowing T-Bone, and isn't this going to be interesting when he's here?
He can fill in all the blanks of the
stars, major people who were on that stage with him. And anyway, there were like 25,000 people out in Austin's sun. It was a hot day. Happily, we were, as I said, under the overhang. And they were rock. And it was so these people were going nuts out there, the 25,000 people in the sun. And they stopped with the jazzy rock music. And T-Bone decided he was going to step into one with his guitar and sing a plaintive ballad. Mm. Perhaps he had just written it. I don't remember. In any event, I had this moment, which was so remarkable in my life. I was there with my daughter. I think she was about 12 at the time. And T-Bone is in one, that is to say, all alone in front of 25,000 people, where the orchestra had been going nuts and the two great stars had been, you know, carrying on. And the audience was wild. The audience was now, this bottle from which I'm taking a drink, is how still is that bottle? That's how still 25,000 people were playing as T-Bone sang this ballad. And I looked at my child, and my child was so caught up in the moment that she almost wasn't there. She was in a space with the 25,000 people who were standing still as a...
And just T-Bone and a guitar, T-Bone, his voice.
T-Bone and a guitar, and I thought... The power of art and music. The power of music. To have them carrying on the way they were carrying on just minutes before and then as still as could be. And this child transported. And the door open.
And here he is.
No, wait a second. There he is.
No, there he is. It's T-Bone, you know, Burnett.
All of the above with Norman Lear.
Hey there, I'm Victoria Shade, the host of PetMD's Life with Pets, where we celebrate pets and the people who love them. Each week on the show, I'll explore a different facet of pet parenting, from troubleshooting challenges like litter box problems to dealing with muddy paw prints on the couch to learning all about how you can help dogs and cats by fostering. You'll hear from amazing guests, and on most episodes, you'll also hear from Millie, my studio pup who likes to snore in the background. We've got new episodes launching every Monday, so make sure to listen exclusively at PodcastOne.com, the new Podcast One app, or at Apple Podcasts. And it would be great if you could rate and review the show so other pet parents can find it. That's PetMD's Life with Pets. Learn, laugh, and become a better pet lover along the way.
Now back to All of the Above with Norman Lear.
When T-Bone comes in, if there are four people or 19 people in front of him, you'll see him. Because I think the man is 9.5 feet tall.
He's very, very tall.
Or he's always seen that way to me. Open the door. Come on in, T-Bone.
T-Bone is here.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
T-Bone Burnett, everybody.
How are you?
Robert Plant and Alison Krauss.
Robert Plant and Alison Krauss were playing.
At
Austin City Limits. And that's when T-Bone stepped into it.
How did they come together? Did you put that together?
No, you know, I wish that I'm glad I got a chance to work with him. But I actually think my friend Bill Flanagan, who is, he used to produce a show called Crossroads at MTV and did a show called Unplugged at MTV. It was an interesting television producer and writer. Brilliant music writer. He does things on CBS Sunday Morning. He does music stories.
Oh, I've seen him. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that was his idea to put the two of them together for one of those Crossroads shows where a rock and roll person sings with a country person.
Yeah.
Well, they were a big hit there. They were terrific.
Yeah. Well, that turned into a whole thing of all its own. You know, they were a powerful duo.
And you produced that record for them?
I did. Yeah.
Yeah. Great. Here we are.
I fall in awe of some of these things. This man has done so much.
So much. From the Rolling Thunder Review to today.
Well, yeah, there's a pretty good story over there, too, I've been following for quite a while.
Oh, this guy. Yeah. Norman's got some. Yeah. From 1922 to today.
T-Bone. It should be said that T-Bone and we, Lynn and I, my wife and I, and his wife Kelly are good friends. And we spend social time together occasionally. And so this is more than just an interview or a discussion or something. This is sharing. I like sharing.
Yeah, me too.
That's true for the hips, too.
Yeah,
that's right.
So what will come out of this is the six of us will have an evening. Everybody's listening and not invited.
Yeah, right.
You can't come.
Very exclusive club.
Yes. Where did that name come from, T-Bone?
You know, I got it when I was about 5 or 6. So, came from around the neighborhood. Excuse me. I moved to Fort Worth, Texas, when I was about 5, 4.
All by yourself?
Well, I did have a couple of parents with me occasionally. I saw them every once in a while, but I was called Bone, I guess, because I was skinny or something along those lines. And then we moved to this other house, and there was a kid right up in the next block called Bone. So I guess I became T-Bone. Although I've told so many lies about that over the years, I have no idea.
Are you telling one now?
Probably, yes.
how great to just naturally have the great rock and roll nickname.
Where did Bone come from?
I guess just because I was skinny, you know. I don't know, really. I don't know how that happened.
So, what on your birth certificate, what reads?
Oh, Joseph Henry Burnett III. It's
Joseph Henry Burnett III and, or T-Bone.
Yeah, none of those names. Henry, though, you know, Callie calls me Henry. I like that. That's a respectable name.
Yeah, Henry's a good
name. It is a respectable name. She doesn't do Hank.
Sometimes she's angry, she does. She'll say. I like Hank,
Hank's
too.
Good, too. They're both good Americana names.
That's true.
Hank Williams, John Henry.
Yeah. O. Henry.
O. Henry. Henry Aaron.
Wordsworth Longfellow.
But a man who moves to Texas when he's 5 years old is really He handles all of that by himself.
Yeah, by yourself. You have to be a tough man.
And yeah, that's right. A tough 5-year-old man. And to get a cool name like T-Bone right off the bat. And then to have Burnett, which, of course, is already a great rock and roll name, the Johnny Burnett Rock and Roll Trio.
Well, and Chester Burnett was Howlin' Wolf.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, and a guy named Richard Burnett, I think it was, wrote that song, Man of Constant Sorrow. He was a blind fiddle player from Kentucky. So I like to fantasize that I'm in that family with Chester Burnett and Richard Burnett.
Yeah, Thanksgiving dinner. That'd be great.
You know, down in Mississippi, they say that the reason there's so much trouble between the races is because we're all related, you know.
I hadn't heard that before, because we're all related.
Yeah.
You know, nobody listening is going to understand this, but we're sitting at a table, but taking the pause, I'll explain it. In the hope you'll understand it. The way the lights are in this studio, my friend and guest is sitting across the table and I can't see his eyes.
Oh, really?
And it's driving me fucking crazy.
Ah, there you are.
There.
That's
are.
Better.
Hello, Tibo.
Oh, good morning.
Good morning.
Big light.
I feel better.
Me too. And
what were you thinking about this morning when you got up?
God, I don't know. You know, I started last year. I took a job writing a musical with Marshall Brickman. Do you remember
Marshall Brickman? Sure.
Incredible 50, 60 years in show business. It was Johnny Carson's head writer and created the Dick Cavett Show. And he did this show called Jersey Boys. It was, did $3 billion worth of business up in Broadway. So he called, and I listened, and he had this idea to do a show about the people who played Roy Rogers and Dale Evans. And the people that played them had much more interesting lives than the people they played, you know. Uh-huh. And so I started getting into studying this sort of phenomenon, this mid-last century phenomenon of the cowboy star and what that was all about. And I took the job for writing a Broadway, hopefully, show, a musical. And then I realized, oh, wait, there's Frank Lesser, you know.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
There's Rodgers and Hart. I'm writing a show. Wait, oh, I have to write 20 good songs, you know, and I don't know if I've written 20 good songs in my whole life. That's quite a lot of good songs.
Yes.
And to have to write them all in 1 year. So I started, it's a long answer to a short question, but I started getting up every morning at 4, just waking up in terror, and started writing at 4, because like from about 4 to 8, it's real quiet in the world and in the house.
Mm.
And I got into this habit for a year, and then I finished the musical, and then I kept writing. So this I wake up every morning
at 4 o'clock.
Yeah, in that state, and I start writing. And let me see what I was thinking about this morning.
What time do you go to bed?
I go to bed usually like 9 or 10 now.
Wow.
It's a whole shift, because I used to go to bed at 5 in the morning.
That's me.
You too?
And I'm thinking I want to start changing that around.
Well, I did it my whole life. And this other thing just kind of
happened.
Because
from gigging, right? You just get from gigging your whole life.
That's
and
right.
You're just on that nightclub schedule.
That's right.
Me too.
Yeah, and also for a musician, it's a good quiet time to work where you're not having to deal with all the ambience of the world around you.
Yeah. And I think the riffs are out there floating around, and there's not all those people awake to grab them. You're the only one to pluck them out of the sky, the riffs and the words.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
But to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning to start writing music or thinking about music and then writing music, that strikes me as so difficult.
It's nothing I wanted to do or even thought about. It's just sort of what started happening.
And where did that kind of discipline come from? I'm alone in the morning. Do you have a cup of coffee?
No. I get up. I don't even get out of bed. I just have my computer. This is like terrible sleep hygiene, by the way. I don't recommend this to anybody.
Right.
But I started going to sleep with my computer there, and I'd wake up at 4. And I would try to go back to sleep. It's not – I wish it were discipline. I would like it to be discipline. But it's more just I couldn't go back to sleep. So, okay, I'm going to start writing. And you're in that half-awake dream state anyway. So you could start, you just start pulling things from everywhere. And also, I have to say, for the last, this year in particular, everything's been in high relief. Everything, we're in such a deep state of global unrest that things have meaning. Yes. Mm. Like in the 1960s, things had this kind of intense meaning. Every word you heard was loaded, you know.
Yeah.
And it's like that now. So it's kind
of, what's the thrust of the piece that you're writing?
Right now, it's about. It's called the. It's a band project. There are five albums I've written so far. It's called The Invisible Light. After T.S. Eliot, Choruses from the Rock, The Invisible Light.
Yeah. Hmm.
And it's each album has a different focus. The first one's called Itopia. And I guess it's about the fact that an autonomous technology has taken control of our cultures, rendering the differences between them superficial, and all of the tension that's causing. Nationalistic tension, the tension between regionalism or globalism and tribalism,
yeah.
You know, and I see it as a problem that's been brought on and caused by technology. So that's the genesis of it, and then the rest of the album deals with the fallout of that. The rest of the five albums, right? I think of it as a five album set.
Are there four albums that are completed, awaiting the fifth?
No, there are three albums that are fairly... There's one album that's finished. There are two that are 80-90% right. finished. And then there are two more that are written that I'm going to be recording this week, actually.
But the first one isn't out until the five are ready. Is that the...
I think I'm going to start putting them out pretty soon because I know what they are. I know the story. So,
So technology, by taking the place of workers, by making it so people don't have to think, by all of these things together, is that what?
Well, I mean, certainly that's part of it, but it's really that we're being robbed of our cultures. I mean, I did a play years ago with Sam Shepard, whom we just lost.
Mm. Yes.
And it was called Tooth of Crime.
Right, great.
And when we were working on it, he said, "Okay, so this is downtown New York, but it only exists on one block in Kansas City, Missouri." You know, this idea that Kurt Anderson has an interesting book called Fantasyland out right now that's on a similar kind of kind of theme. The way we delude ourselves. Well, certainly that's all I've ever written about, really, is self-delusion, and it's even on a national scale, the way we lie to ourselves and the problems that causes.
Mm.
You know, the psychiatrists have a saying, you're as sick as you are secret.
You're sick as your secret.
Yeah, and I feel like we, especially I grew up in the South, you know, we in the South keep a lot of secrets from ourselves.
Yeah.
You know, regarding the war of northern aggression, for instance, and these sort of genetic theories, the unfounded genetic theories we have regarding race. I'm a believer in la raza cosmica, you know, that we're all one race, the human race.
And yeah.
So.
Well, that's why my bumper sticker reads, "Just another version of you."
Yeah, that's right. That's
we are versions of one another.
That's right. That's right.
But. I mean, I love the seriousness of this conversation. I had no guess that we were going to get this serious. But I think, too, coming at it perhaps from a slightly different angle, the biggest lie we tell ourselves as Americans has something to do with, and our behavior goes with it, like we're God's chosen.
Right.
And we have, you know, as somebody who served in World War II, came out of that war and was so proud of an America that could help get Germany and Europe on its feet after a terrible war with the Marshall Plan, which, you know, was responsible for all of Europe getting back on its feet. Every reason to be proud. But then we started to believe our press.
Yeah, that's so true. Yeah.
And suddenly, you know, we could do no wrong. and made, you know, as a result of that, one mistake after another.
Vietnam. Yeah. To start it off, you know.
Extraordinary American exceptionalism, which is such a
Manifest Destiny. I would say probably it was an early version of that, right? That we deserved everything to the ocean, and we'll just move everybody out who's in our way.
Yeah,
you know, and we haven't been well anyway. You know,
watch the Ken Burns Vietnam documentary, and I learned a lot, and I was also just blown away at the hubris or the. You know, that version of American exceptionalism. We do anything we want, wherever we want, and have for a very long time. And it seems there's nothing new under the sun. Yeah. It was, you know, I was a kid then. For instance, I didn't know in 68 election that Nixon talked to the South Vietnamese about backing out of the peace talks.
Yeah.
I mean, I had no idea.
For his election.
There's nothing new. The Russians have...
Yeah. Right. Oh, yeah. Right. But and you know, another how many 20,000 young men died so that Nixon could get reelected.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, where does that come? That one is that a want for power that could allow you to ignore that fact that one person would die, let alone 20,000 kids.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. It's hubris, is that the word you use?
Yeah.
That's and that also self-deceit.
Yeah.
That idea that somehow he was the one that was supposed to be there, and it was important enough to shed the blood of 20 virgins.
Right. And the way he talked about his reelection on the tapes, it was as if it needed to happen for a greater good, for the great good.
That's right.
Not that it was him that wanted to be reelected.
Yeah. I'm glad I was on his enemies list.
You were on his enemies. What a great thing.
Yes, I made it.
And the tapes of him talking about you and Archie Bunker are the best. Have you heard those?
No. What does he say?
He was.
He's a goddamn
they made fool. They made fool a fool of a good man. This Archie Bunker. They're making fool of a good man, especially when he learned that his hero, a football player, professional football player, he learned from the man himself that the guy was gay.
Oh.
And Nixon is quoted as saying, that's what brought down Greece. I mean, you know, the homos brought down Greece, is the way he put it in his Nixonian style.
Well, he was a deep historian. So.
So what are you laughing at these days with all that seriousness, T-Bone?
Let's see. What did I laugh at? I've had a wild day today, I have to say. So, backtracking for a moment.
Yes.
I just saw, off the record probably, but Alfonso Cuarón has an incredible new movie he's done down in Mexico. And he screened it for me today.
Uh-huh.
And it's one of the most powerful movies I've ever seen. It's called Roma at the moment. It's an incredible movie. But I walked out of this movie... You know, I was sobbing at places in the movie. It's powerful. It's in black and white. He recreated 1970s Mexico City, you know, tile by tile. It's incredible.
Wow.
And no actors involved at all. It's all people he found. And it's on an epic scale. But it's about essentially a nanny or a housekeeper and a family. And the family. At any rate, I walked out of that and heard Tom Petty had died. Oh, you know, so
yes.
So yeah. I'm sort of so in that place just right at this moment. It's just all
shocking, so sad.
It's tough.
Yeah,
you were very close to Petty.
Well, I loved him. We weren't close friends, but I held him in highest regard, and we were friends to be sure.
Yeah.
And I did the Grammy tribute to him last year. Remember that Dylan show we went to?
Yes.
Oh, Person of the Year.
Yeah, Person of the Year.
So I music directed the one for Tom last year. So it's, you know, I don't know what happened. And then that concert last night, I mean, it's just
the thing last night in Las Vegas with 58 people getting.
So what have I been
laughing? We're talking to an audience that, you know, that will be listening to this in some days or weeks or from now.
Yeah, no,
but this is a big moment. It's okay to talk about it.
Yeah.
They're certainly going to remember the night when, I don't know, at the moment, 58 people were killed and 500 wounded.
500.
By a man with 10 or more attack guns in a hotel room.
Yeah.
And what do we, and God, I say this with no, I take no pride being my age and having done nothing. I should have been arrested 18 times for how angry it makes me that in using the Second Amendment, we've got a country that says a man can have that amount of guns, attack guns, and it, like he needs it.
Like anyone in Las Vegas, you're free to walk around with a machine gun. How does anyone need to walk around with a machine gun?
Oh, that's, I wondered how he got into, how he brought all those guns into the hotel. He can carry a gun, that an attack gun. He can walk outside with an attack gun.
Yeah.
Well, it's madness.
Complete madness. So that's what we woke up. And then Tom Petty, of course, this morning went into cardiac arrest, and he's at UCLA Medical Center. Has he died, or is he still?
I think he's gone.
Yeah.
But what has been funny lately? I don't know. I can't grab anything right now.
Well, it starts with we have you know the biggest office in the Western world. The man, I can't even begin the sentence that ends with "Look at the President of the United States."
Yeah,
I mean this has happened. In our, you know, in recent months in our lives as we live it, it's just impossible to believe.
There's nothing funny about it. See, that's the problem. He's not, I wish he were funny. I think Jon Stewart probably did a really good thing by getting out of Dodge, you know.
Right in time. Because there's no irony, there's no...
There's nothing you can do. It's...
Yeah, you could always have a politician. To this guy, there's just nothing funny.
He dedicates a golf trophy to the people in Puerto Rico, you know.
Yeah. Did he do that?
Yeah, he did that yesterday. The President's Cup, he showed up for the President's Cup, which I don't know what that has to do with the president or which president they're even talking about or which cup for that matter.
Right.
And he showed up at the President's Cup, the first president to ever do it, and then dedicated the cup to Puerto Rico.
On a day that he spent tweeting from the golf course, railing against that brave mayor of Puerto Rico, who's truly in dire straits, and he's on the golf course taking shots at her. The president of the United States.
Yeah, well.
So anyway.
if we were if this was 5 years ago, we were sitting around and tried to write the screenplay that this represents. Never have thought of it.
But who
that this could happen? That somebody like that could fall into that.
Who defends him? Let's just assume, for the sake of the conversation, that we there's a two party system. We know what Democrats are. Republicans, that they're smaller government, less taxes, maybe more conservative. You know, socially. Who's left to defend this guy? Like, what true Republicans? I mean, and the things he says and that he tweets, they're just anti-American. The whole Russian thing. They're defending that. How far will it go?
Well, they're all defending it. I mean, Paul Ryan's holding his job. He's not giving up his job. So in a sense, if you're not saying, you know, calling it what it is, you're defending it.
At what point do we reach the indefensible? Okay, now it's the indefensible. I guess we don't.
Well, it's all indefensible as far as I'm concerned, every bit of it.
You have a computer there. With music.
Yeah.
Before we get any further in this, let me ask you about that.
You want me to play you a song?
I'd love to play a song.
This is a song for that show I did with Marshall Brickman that I like, that I think you might enjoy. Which one of these is working?
Either one.
Okay, let's try this.
You're talking about a guitar you reach for? There are two of them there.
There's a pick in there.
Oh. That might be part of it. Everybody wants to know the truth, but nobody wants to hear it. Everybody has to face the end, but nobody wants to get near it. Everybody wants peace, but nobody wants to surrender. Everyone lives in the past, but nobody seems to remember. Nobody knows the end of the story. We must wait for it to unfold. Everybody wants to live a long time, but nobody wants to get old. Everybody wants to be forgiven, but nobody wants to confess. Everyone longs to hold on to a moment that no one can ever possess. Everyone wants to be free, but no one can pay the price. Everyone wants to be heard when nobody asks for advice. Nobody knows the end of the story that can neither be bought nor sold. Everybody wants to live a long time, but nobody wants to get old. There is nothing as long as never, and nothing so hard to hold. Everybody wants to live forever, but nobody wants to get old.
Oh, yeah. That's terrific. That's terrific. That's the result of a 4 o'clock date with yourself?
That's right.
4 a.m. date.
That's it, yeah. So, yeah, that's Roy. That's a song Roy Rogers comes on with. That's his first song he ever wrote. Or Leonard Sly, actually, is the guy's name.
Uh-huh.
See, I thought Roy Rogers and Dale Evans actually played. I mean, were. Cause on the,
wait, so
the,
do I.
In the movies, it said Roy Rogers by Dale, by Roy Rogers. But Roy Rogers' name was Leonard Sly. And Dale Evans' name was Francis Fox.
I had no idea.
Yeah. She wrote, she was a great songwriter. She wrote Happy Trails, and she wrote Jesus Loves Me.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, they're really extraordinary people. They were wild people. Completely, you know, every television show was exactly the same. You know, it was Perils of Pauline. And
yeah.
Roy wrote in. And,
uh-huh. Where were they from? Where was he from, Roy Rogers?
He was from Duck Run, Ohio. And they say that the second base at Riverfront Stadium was where his home was, and that every time Pete Rose slid into second base, he said, Roy Rogers.
Oh, that's great.
But he his family lost the farm in the Depression. He moved to Bakersfield. He was picking oranges for Del Monte. Got a job. Right.
How did he get into show business?
He was being an extra in Westerns because he was a good rider.
Uh-huh.
And his band, in Bakersfield, in some ways he started the Bakersfield sound because his band was became known as the Sons of the Pioneers. And they were really good writers. Yeah. And they were doing, they were in a Gene Autry movie where they were the band in the saloon. And Gene Autry quit because he couldn't get any of the merchandising. The owner of the studio of Republic Studios wouldn't give him any of the
merchandise. That was going on back then, too,
yeah.
Huh?
So he quit, and the head of the studio was, they were having a casting call for the next music star, and the head of, next cowboy star, and the head of the studio saw Roy and said, what's your name? And he said, Leonard Sly, and he said, not anymore, you know. And they called him Roy Rogers because of Will Rogers and Jimmy Rogers, who... Leonard Sly was actually a very good Jimmy Rogers impersonator. You know,
wow.
He was a very good singer. Mm. Leonard Sly.
Yeah.
And they called him Roy because the head of the studio wanted to face Gene Autry, so he, Roy, so he was the new king of the Cowboys. So
And when did Dale come into the picture?
She came in about a few years later. She was a girl who was 15 when she had her first baby, and the husband left. She was from rural Illinois somewhere. And she moved to Chicago, got a job in an insurance company, started working in a cabaret. She wanted to be a musical comedy star like Ginger Rogers.
Uh-huh.
And she married a wealthy Chicago guy, and he told her to quit show business, and she told him to go to hell and went out to Hollywood. And by the time she got to Hollywood, her son was 15. She was 30 at this point. So when she got an agent, he said, well, you can't be 30 and just get to Hollywood. So you're 20, and now your son is your brother. So for all those years, she raised her son as her brother until the Korean War, when the draft statistics were published, and Luella Parsons saw it and publicized it and disgraced Dale Evans. But in the mid 40s, 47 or something, she started doing a few shows with Roy Rogers.
Uh-huh.
So he had to determine at this point in his life whether he was going to continue being a movie star or was he going to stay with this woman that he had taken up with. And they had three or four or five kids themselves, and they had adopted three or four or five special needs kids. He was a really soft-hearted cat.
Yeah.
And so he decided, oh, to hell with it. There's this new medium, television. I don't need to be a movie star. She had gone up to the ranch and wouldn't come off it. She was so humiliated by Luella Parsons. So he moved the whole thing up to the ranch. They got a TV show. Never left the ranch. They shot it there. Trigger was this whole family horse.
Oh, for crying out loud. This is the story you're telling in the music.
This is going to be a great show.
What a story.
With Marshall Brinkman, yeah.
But the amazing thing is, you know, it's my generation to know and understand something about Roy Rogers and Dale Evans, that she had a 15-year-old son when she was 30, that she, that part of the, I mean, yeah. It's amazing that is a story to tell that nobody knows.
And an heroic move by him to say, I'll just go into this new technology, sight unseen.
Yeah.
You know, and did very well with it. I think they had that show for 10 years, and
I think it's interesting we get the great Roy Rogers because another great singing cowboy left, so they needed to replace him.
Yeah.
Happy trails to you.
Yeah.
It's like Gene Vincent.
And that's the name of it, Happy Trails.
Happy Trails.
Of course, you know.
Like, Capitol needed somebody to compete with this new rock and roll guy, Elvis Presley, so they signed Gene Vincent.
Exactly.
So without that, there'd have been no Gene Vincent.
Right, that's right.
Yeah.
Elvis invented a lot of stuff.
Vincent Craddock, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
A lot of
Do you know this guy's story in terms of Broadway and London and the stage and so forth?
I did a play about Buddy Holly, originated the role of Buddy in London and on Broadway.
Oh, right.
And I love all that music.
Yeah, I love Buddy, you know, it's so Texas.
Just so, yeah. And I've never been. I've only been on Surprise Platinum for years, and I have to go to Texas.
You haven't been to Texas?
Only on stage. Spent a lot of time in Texas on stage.
Well, you know, you can't get to Texas on a stage
anymore. You know, your great song, River of Love, that reminds me a lot of a Buddy Holly. Like, I can hear the through line. It's definitely your song, and it's your unique sound, but I can hear that great through line of Buddy Holly.
Totally. Buddy Holly, I think the first song that ever completely flipped my wig was Ray Vaughan.
Yeah.
You know.
How's it go?
Hell, the little things that you say and do, they make me want. Should we do it? We got guitar.
Yeah. Let me go. Go ahead. I got to hear this.
Yeah, you do it. I'll do this one.
Well, what does the average listener have to know about Buddy Holly?
That his should know his entire career from start to finish was 18 months.
Yeah.
And that includes being a country singer, then seeing Elvis Presley, and switching over to rock and roll. But he did this. You hit the little things that you say to do, made me want to be with you. Parade on, it's a crazy feeling, and I know it's got me reeling with you. Say, I love you, parade on. We dance and hold me tight.
You know,
that song is so great. The record, as soon as you go, and they come charging out of that thing.
But to sit here and have you guys say, let's sing, and watch you pick up the guitars. You met today. You don't even know each other.
We met. What we do now?
But you picked up the guitars and boom.
Yeah.
Right into the song.
Well, if you're going to do Rave On, you don't want to. You don't want to leave anything in the bag.
Right, exactly.
As somebody who couldn't begin to do it, I just am.
But you know, we come from the same place. When I was a kid, I grew up and I heard Gene Vincent. I heard these guys and I loved it. This was. In Philadelphia, I was growing up. You know, in WFIO, you would hear these things. So when you started making records, for me, it was kind of, the year did you make your first solo record? First T-Bone Burnett record.
Like 1980 or something.
So it was just, for a lot of us, it was like, wow, this guy from the stuff that we love, you know, you're so steeped in it all, but modern. And
well, I'd been behind the scenes for a long time before I forced myself out.
You were in A&R. How did you end up in Bob Dylan's Rolling Thunder Review, which is one of the great classic tours of all time with Mick Ronson and Joan Baez? And
you know, Bobby Newirth. Do you know Newirth? Bobby Newirth's one of the most interesting cats I've ever met. And he and Bob put that show together. And Newirth and I had been hanging out up in Woodstock and writing and singing, playing.
Yeah.
We were friends.
And that's how that came, how you ended up on the tour.
Yeah, he invited me. He invited me on the tour, and I went. And I'd never been on stage. I was petrified.
How old were you?
I was probably 27, something like that.
But wow.
I always wanted to, you know, when I was a kid, I thought I'll be Burt Bacharach. Here's the ideal life. You write songs for the movies, and you're married to Angie Dickinson, and you go swimming in the afternoon, and, you know. you know, I had no desire to be out in front of it myself.
What pushed you out front?
Poverty. You know, I had to make a living finally, and I was being a freelance writer and a freelance record producer. I had a bunch of songs. I had 20 or 30 songs, and nobody was doing them, so I just started doing them. I started going out about 1980.
Yeah. And you were.
What was the first song that put you on? Really get you started.
I don't know. You know, there was one that was really an interesting song, which I did a version of "Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend," but I did it in sort of a Beat Generation version of "Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend" because I always thought this is such an interesting, caustic, smart lyric, and it's always done as a. Is a happy jive song, but it's really a dead serious song. You know, I thought it'd be funny to hear a guy sing this. And and I think really, I mean, the thing that put me on was Dylan and Newirth. You know, they put me out in front of, you know, Dylan can make you famous just sitting across the table from you.
Well, that took a little more than that for you. A lot of good music. But at 27, you're suddenly thrust forward, and you're on the stage. Do you remember that first moment?
I do.
What were you doing?
It was oddly enough, it was at Plymouth. It was at Plymouth, Massachusetts, in a little 500-seat theater. And there were 500 people in the theater and I think several thousand outside the theater trying to get in, you know. And it was incredibly happy, so you couldn't do anything wrong, you know. So that was good. It was like being carried around on the hands of the audience, the way that happens. But then Dylan came out and he played a couple of songs and I was playing with him. And then he picked up the harmonica and blew two notes, and the whole place just came completely apart. It was the loudest noise I've ever heard. And that shot me into some other way of looking at show business altogether. I realized the potential of an artist and all his history and the history he draws from. I don't know, I saw a whole lot of things just in that moment. Because it was like little Walter walked in. But suddenly it was just like pandemonium. So,
yeah. had the audience not expected? Was this the first time he picked up a harmonica?
Yeah, I mean, I think he had played a few songs, and everybody was in ecstasy at any rate, but there was something about that harmonica, you know.
That moment.
Like, oh, yeah, it sort of stamped it. Like, this really is it, you know.
His sound, the sound of that, him playing is very unique. So when you hear it, you instantly know it.
Yeah, it was just so. And I think he had been gone for a long time at that point, too, you know.
That's right.
And also in a little 500-seat place.
1975, correct?
75, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I remember I read Ratzo's book. I need to reread that.
Ratzo. Larry Sloman.
Yeah.
He was a character.
Yeah. He wrote a book about this tour, about the Rolling Thunder Review tour.
It was a crazy tour. One story is there was a People magazine writer there to do a story on Bob, and Bob wouldn't meet with him. So Bob, I was in my hotel room one night about 8 or 9 o'clock after rehearsal, and Bob said, "Hey, T-Bone, go down to the bar. There's this guy from People magazine. He wants to do an interview, and just go talk to him. He wants to interview somebody, so go talk to him." So I went down to the bar, introduced myself. The guy said, "You know, Bob said he was coming down. Has Bob come down?" I said, "I don't think he is. I think he sent me down here to..." And he said, "Well, if he doesn't come down here, I'm going to do a hatchet job on Bob Dylan." Like, and I said, "Do you really think Bob Dylan cares if People magazine does a hatchet job on him? Is that what you want to do? Seriously?" And I don't know. And then we ended up getting drunk, and so Bob had made a good choice for somebody to defuse this guy, you know.
And did he do an okay piece? Did he? I don't know.
I never read it. I'm sure.
Are you in touch with him?
No. With Bob? Off and on, yeah. We've just done a thing together. We still stay in good touch, yeah.
That's great.
His buddy, his bass player, Tony Garnier, is a good buddy of mine.
I love Tony.
Yeah. And when they come out to record or rehearse, Tony's a cigar smoker. I'm a cigar smoker, too. And we smoke cigars together. And he never gives me any information. I'm just waiting for him to tell me one thing every cigar, and I need and never get anything out of him.
You know.
Many Bob stories.
Do you smoke a cigar occasionally?
Not anymore. No. I did. I used to, but many years ago.
I asked because we have a cigar smoking group who loves good wine and good food, and we will, everybody plays an instrument but me, but I sing loudly and poorly. But we'll sit till 2 o'clock in the morning on the deck overlooking the valley in front of us.
Yeah.
And
just play.
And play.
Smoke cigars. And drink wine. Well, everybody but me drinks wine.
Yeah. And I've said on this podcast any number of times, if there was no other reason to believe in God, it would be Havana Leaf.
That's our byline. Can I ask you a guitar geek question?
Sure.
Mick Ronson. So you work with Mick on that tour. Now, Mick Ronson, for the listeners and for Norman, Mick Ronson was this phenomenal guitar player who came to fame with Bowie and the Spiders from Mars band, and then went on to work with you guys and Ian Hunter and you. So what was it like working with Mick Ronson?
Well, Mick was an incredibly generous artist and very brave. He didn't need any notes or chords or anything like that. He just played. He just played. Music came out of him unfiltered in an exciting way.
Yeah.
He didn't, like, play shapes or, you know, just, I don't know. He had a unique approach to music, so it was thrilling working with him, and that freedom.
Yeah.
You know, that's the thing I've always been looking for, and it's taken me really until now. I'm just beginning to get the kind of freedom that I heard in Ray Charles or Muddy Waters when I was a kid. You know, I would hear this ease of...
Explain everything you mean with the word freedom in this context.
Not, you know, having nothing between you and the note, having no self, don't having yourself between the note, you know, don't have anything, any filter or any judgment at all, just to be able to say, just pure generosity, raw generosity. Here's this tone. This is the tone that I think describes this moment and this environment. Something like that, and being able to find the tone without having to go through the theory.
Yeah.
You know, theory.
Is jazz the best expression of that?
Yeah, jazz. Well, that's what jazz was all about. The jazz bebop, which is really where what I'm talking about started in the 40s, was when a time there were a bunch of extraordinarily gifted and brilliant dance musicians that played with Billy Eckstein and Duke Ellington, etc. And when the war happened, the dancing stopped. All the men went away, and the musicians went up to New York and would sit around, and they started saying, okay, you're not dancing now, sit down. Like at Minton's, everybody sat down. And the musicians became intellectuals. You know, Sartre came over from Europe during the war, and Dizzy Gillespie started wearing berets and Sartre glasses, and they were saying, okay, now we're not dance musicians, and we're not here to entertain you. We're here to show you this world of freedom, this world of beyond. So yeah, it started then in that, and especially in bebop, I would say even more than jazz. Listen, Louis Armstrong, there's never been a freer musician than Louis Armstrong. He knew all the notes, but they just flew out of him. So that's the thing, like the unconsidered note or the note that just comes right out of your breath, you know.
Even the freedom to go to the obvious.
Yeah, that's
just
true,
and
too.
Not judge it.
Yeah, that's right. Whatever it is,
Yes.
I moved to do an imitation of Armstrong. It's a wonderful world. Now, I hear him clearly.
It was just like him.
Uncanny.
Oh, my God, how I love his rendition of that.
I
can't hear that without everything being wonderful in this world.
You know what I loved about him was that, you know, about, he was obsessed with tape recording stuff. Yeah. He was big into tape recording stuff.
Have you been
stuff.
Up to his house?
I have. I want to go. It's in Brooklyn, correct?
Well, it's Queens, I think.
Queens.
But, yeah, it's up there.
Yeah, I want to go there, and they have his recording, his tape machine and everything.
Yeah, his wife just has preserved it exactly as it was when he left us, you know. Yeah.
Is it kind of a museum?
A museum now.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. It's one of the best museums in New York, a town with a lot of good museums.
But yeah.
That's a good one.
And he lived there a long, long time.
Yeah,
right?
That was his path.
How do you have to be 95 years old to learn about this?
Yeah.
I just learned about this. This couldn't be more interesting to me, and I had to wait all this time to learn there's a Louis Armstrong Museum.
Well, I would love to go up there with you.
Oh, my God, would I love that.
Yeah, I want to go with that.
I'm going east tomorrow. Shall we all go?
Yeah.
I'm in. Well, I'm playing the Hardly Strictly Bluegrass Festival Friday.
Oh, yes.
So I might be able to come up on the weekend, though.
Where is that?
It's in San Francisco in Golden Gate Park.
Oh, cool.
There's this incredible festival up there that a man named Warren Hellman endowed that has 750,000 people a year come to this free outdoor festival. And the city of San Francisco gave him the prettiest weekend of the year every year, and he supports his endowment supports this. He died about 2 or 3 years ago. Mm. He was a wonderful guy.
Cool.
And a great lover of bluegrass. He ran Levi's for years. He told me, actually, when his family first came to Los Angeles, there were only 1,000 people there. So,
is that right?
Really?
Yeah, so they were Wells Fargo. And, it's a deep California family. But that's the kind of largesse, I guess, you can expect out of that. Because that festival's been going on probably 10 or 15 years. And it's completely changed the landscape of American music, I would say.
Will you be playing bluegrass? Yeah.
No, I'm playing this wild electronic music I'm writing. I've started writing. I call it trip visualist music.
Trip
visualist.
And that would be like, would Zombieland fall under that?
No, that's on the way there, but no, yeah. It's I'd love to play you some of it.
Yeah.
But it's
do you mean now?
Huh?
Do you mean now?
Oh, I could play it for you.
Yes, I hoped you did. I'd love to hear a little.
To beat the devil, you must be a shadow. You must go deep as he stays shallow. To beat the devil, you must be wise. There is nothing he can.
you build that track? Do you start with drums and
we've been doing it. I've been recording at my house, and Jay Bellarose, who's playing drums, is in one room, and then Kefis and I are in the other room, and we're just jamming. It's jazz, you know. We just go. We have a lyric, and we're working from the lyric. So
that's cool.
And then we've triggering, and yeah, it's fun. Really,
you wrote the lyric.
I did. Yeah.
Wonderful.
Are you using software? Software?
Yeah, oh yeah, like crazy.
Like Kontakt or something?
Yeah, all of that. Yeah,
I love Kontakt.
Yeah, I use Kontakt a lot.
I'm a gearhead.
Yeah, I like it too. I really like it.
Yeah. It's really cool. I can't wait to hear it on big speakers.
I want you to hear what's really there, because you can only hear about like 3% of what's there.
Yeah. You start out with a lyric, so this might be something you've written in the morning. When you wake up with your laptop, is that what you're doing, just kind of writing lyrics?
Just that. Yeah, that's what I'm doing. I'm writing lyrics. But the lyrics, I mean, any of those lyrics can turn into a melody at any second, you know, because it's melody is codified inflection, you know, so you're giving meaning to the line through melody when you're doing it this way, rather than writing a melody and then fitting words to it.
Yeah.
It's acting. It's like an acting job.
Codified inflection.
Yeah. Melody.
Yeah.
It's telling people how the line's supposed to go, you know.
You probably surprise yourself, or the music surprises you too sometimes doing that.
Well, it's hopefully, yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, so you're doing that, and then you're doing the Roy Rogers stuff.
Yeah. We're doing a lot of stuff.
Oh, my God, you're doing a lot of stuff.
And they're so distant. I love that they're so different. They couldn't be more different, right?
This is the best time of my life. Is this the best time of your life, do you think? I mean, you've had so many great times. But...
Well, it's the best time of my life because it is the moment I'm living.
Because it's now.
Because
right?
It's now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The fact is, incontrovertible. It took you every split second of the life you have lived to put your hand down just now.
Yeah, that's right.
And to shake your head, yeah, that's right at me.
That's right.
It took me every split second of my life to say everything I'm saying this moment and tap my finger.
That's it.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you not value that moment?
That's it. That's
and it's
it.
Only in the now that you can find that.
Yeah, that's it.
You know, that happiness. That contentedness.
And with all of that understanding, I can't wake up at 4 o'clock tomorrow morning and start writing.
I want to do that. I wish I could do that. I want to do that. Django Reinhardt used to wake up and stay in bed and just practice.
Really?
And play guitar for hours and hours. Yeah. And, you know, drink coffee and smoke Galois probably.
Yeah. Doesn't sound bad.
Yeah. Churchill also. Churchill would wake up and get all of his paperwork. He'd stay in bed for hours, have a big English fry-up, a couple of cocktails and a few cigars, and then get out of bed. In the morning, and then get to work.
Oh, my God. Wild man.
Yeah, there are some things that make me sound sane to myself. Hearing that about church.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Yeah.
Well, I've got a thumbs up from our group in the booth.
Can we do River of Love before we
do it?
Do you remember the words? You know
that? Yeah, I can do. But, you know, I have to say I've had a horrible allergy.
Oh, okay. Well, then if you don't.
That, I think, is too much breath for me to attempt right
now. River of Love.
But I loved hearing that new one. Just
that's pretty,
it's
right?
Wonderful.
Amazing.
It's wonderful.
Yeah.
It's wonderful.
Yeah, really great.
Well, this has been great. T-Bone Burnett.
So happy to see you.
I'm so happy to see you, too, and have you caged here with us.
Yeah, what a thrill.
It's great. And this has been All of the Above with T-Bone Burnett, our guest, and Paul Hipp. This is Norman Lear saying, once again, All of the Above.
What does it mean? This life, this day and night.
So I'm Norman Lear, and you can find me, should you wish to hunt me down, you can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at The Norman Lear.
And you can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Paul Hipp.
Have some of mine, and life is good, and space and time, give me some of yours. Give you some of mine.